You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. We're talking about how much Wisconsin stay-at-home order has affected how we're all traveling. And we've got a new piece from WisconTex that looks at what publicly available location tracking data actually reveals. That's ahead on the show. Now, COVID-19 is affecting nearly every part of our lives, and that includes preschool education. Wisconsin children enrolled in pre-kindergarten classes are still finding some learning opportunities when they're away from their desks during Wisconsin's Safer at Home order. I have a kid in 4K, and here she is talking about one of her activities she's got to accomplish today.
And this one includes cupcake liners, write in numbers with permanent markers in the bottom of the inside cupcake liners, and find in some little...
Yeah, and in the 2018-2019 school year, kids are looking for this. Last time around, Wisconsin enrolled nearly 3,000 more children in preschool than the year before. And that happened at the same time that the total state funding for preschool adjusted for inflation went down about 11%. And spending per child also declined. That's according to a new report from the National Institute for Early Education Research. The report also outlines some major negative impacts on pre-K education following the Great Recession. It also calls on policymakers to consider ways to avoid having the same things happen as we emerge from this coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Stephen Barnett is founder and senior co-director of the Institute based out of the Rutgers Graduate School of Education. Dr. Barnett, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Keeley. Glad to be here.
Let's start by going backwards with the Great Recession. This report, it was actually supposed to be released earlier in the year, but then you delayed it because of there needed to be kind of a cautionary tale about the long-term dangers associated with economic crisis. So how was pre-K affected by the 2008 financial crisis?
The last crisis really hit pre-K hard. Enrollment went down, spending went down, states reduced their quality standards. So across the board, we saw cuts. And when you're 4 years old, there's not a second chance at pre-K.
And then why are we talking about that? I mean, can we draw some parallels between 2008 and what's happening now?
It's certainly a lot of uncertainty now, but the chair of the St. Louis Federal Reserve said that the economic impact of COVID-19 is not comparable to anything we've seen in U.S. macroeconomic history ever. That's not a good sign.
So you're saying that we might be able to draw parallels, but what's happening now is worse than what happened
exactly
a decade ago.
It's certainly deeper. Whether it's as long-lasting, we don't know. But I think it's a warning from 2008 that the worst years for pre-K, funded by state government, were 2 years after the economic recovery had already started.
Then why the delay? Why isn't it a problem when, you know, wages are down immediately and when people are struggling in that moment? Why do we see the effects as things are recovering?
State budgets lag. State revenues come back later than the economy does. Sales taxes don't rev up immediately, income taxes, property taxes. So the revenues are slower to come back. And yet, you're quite right. You have, at the same time, a decrease in families' abilities to be able to provide high-quality early learning experiences on their own, and tight state budgets that lead to reductions in the quality, if not quantity, of services.
Dr. Barnett, then what are a few of the policy recommendations you're making then to protect or maybe even advance pre-K while we're in this pandemic and as we get out of it?
Well, one of the good things we see is that preschool is a bipartisan issue. It's not conservative or liberal. It's not Democrat or Republican. And so we're hopeful that the federal government will step up and offer states some fiscal relief that will be extended to pre-K. $1 or $2 billion a year would close the anticipated gap for the entire country. We're also looking to see better coordination between federal and state programs so we can work smarter, not just harder, to improve services to kids. And then finally, we want states to put serious resources into planning. How are we going to provide a good remote education should we have to close again? How do we make up for the losses of children who've been out of their programs? And how do we prepare for the long term, both so that we're better prepared the next time we have something like this, and also so that long term we put these precarious preschool programs on a better financial footing for the future?
Dr. Stephen Barnett is founder and senior co-director of the National Institute for Early Education Research. That's at the Rutgers Graduate School of Education. And we're talking about pre-kindergarten classes and Wisconsin's place in them. So let's get into those numbers, Dr. Barnett. As far as 2019 is concerned, what stands out to you the most when you're looking at how Wisconsin performed that year?
What stands out the most is that funding per child fell over $650, and that's in a year before the crisis. So when people are talking about cuts or hold the line, we can't have any increases in spending, they typically don't take into account that preschool is not a mature program like many of the others. It doesn't reach all the eligible children, and its budget is more unsure and as we've seen, not good in the best of years.
Do we know why that is? Why we don't across the board fund pre-kindergarten classes the same way we fund K-12?
Well, it's not required, and I think that people still haven't come to fully appreciate that early learning sets the foundation for later success, that it's very difficult to make up for not providing an adequate early education before kids get to kindergarten. And so it just falls off when budgets get tight, sometimes intentionally because it doesn't have a strong constituency or interest group behind it. Sometimes I think it's just forgotten. It's a kind of orphan program.
This report has Wisconsin meeting an average of 3 out of 10 quality standard benchmarks. Where are we falling short?
Well, Wisconsin falls short primarily because it emphasizes local control, and that allows a lot of flexibility. But it means that there aren't standards for class size and ratio, and small classes, individualized attention are key for effective programs. It means there aren't the same kinds of standards, whether children are in public or non-public programs that receive public funding, for the professional development, ongoing continuous improvement, even down to the level of vision, hearing, and health screenings and referrals aren't required. And yet we know if a child can't see or has a hearing problem, that's going to be a lifetime of difficulty if it's not addressed early.
There are some notes of optimism in this report, though, despite the grim economic outlook we're facing. Can you talk about where we can find some hope as states are evaluating their budgets and spending on pre-K going forward?
Well, we can find hope in the bipartisan spirit behind support for pre-K. Red states and blue states are equally enthusiastic, and there are not a lot of issues for which that's true. And so I think that's one reason we are hopeful that Congress might come together to support dedicated funding for early childhood programs. It's the reason that we think that states might come together and coalesce over protecting our youngest, most vulnerable children in a time of budget cuts.
Dr. Barnett, thank you so much for joining us and explaining it.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Stephen Barnett, founder and senior co-director of the National Institute for Early Education Research. We talked with him today about the Institute's 2019 State of Preschool Report, and you can read that on our website. Just go to WPR.org. We've got a link set up for you there. Coming up, we're talking about what location tracking data from our cell phones tells us about how our movements have changed since Wisconsin's stay-at-home order took effect. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, states are facing big financial challenges during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's not certain whether the federal government will offer more support. We're talking about options on the table and catching up on other stories in national politics ahead. First, Wisconsin's Safer at Home order has been in effect for more than a month now, and as people follow the rules to stay home most of the time, it's fair to assume we'd see a drop-off in daily travel. But exactly how big has that drop been, and how did the changes in travel look different depending on what part of the state you're in? Our partners at WisconText are taking a stab at those questions in their latest piece. It uses publicly available cell phone tracking data to show how our movements have changed during the outbreak. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisconText. Will, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Keeley. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about where this location tracking data that you looked at in your piece actually comes from.
Right. It comes from any app on a smartphone, whether you have an iPhone or a Google Android or some other smartphone on a different operating system. A lot of apps on smartphones allow you to track your location or ask the user to allow location tracking for a whole number of reasons, whether it's to provide driving directions or other navigation directions, hook you up with a ride share, or any other. There are tons and tons of reasons why location tracking might be useful. And so the data comes from there.
So help us connect the dots then. My opting in to let an app tell me where to go translates into us being able to understand how people are following the stay-at-home order?
Yeah, it's there's a bit of a leap there, isn't there? So basically, you have these app developers like Google, who has like a Google Apps and other apps that can help provide you with information related to like how busy a restaurant or a store is at a certain time. And then any number of other app developers may hold contracts with third-party data vendors where they sell anonymized versions of this aggregated data to these third-party vendors who then can package it up and make it useful to other companies or researchers who may find value in that location tracking data, whether it's to understand movements of people, as a lot of researchers would like to, or for targeted advertising. There's a whole host of reasons why companies or researchers might find this information valuable. So these third-party vendors, some of them have provided this data for free during the COVID-19 pandemic, so people can kind of understand better how movement patterns are changing. And then there's other app developers such as Google, a major one, who are just providing their data for free directly. They're not even working through a third-party vendor.
So what do you find then? I mean, what does this data that is now publicly available show after Safer at Home went into effect in our state?
Sure. We looked at data from both Google and then other data provided by a third-party vendor called Cubic. They primarily work in the advertising realm, but they have made a lot of their data public. And we found that in about mid-March, when things really started heating up in Wisconsin and nationally related to COVID-19, and as public health orders came down, I believe the Safer at Home order came on March 24th. What we saw was a huge reduction in the number of people who are venturing from their homes. So people who are adhering to this public health advice across the state. And we saw about twice as many people after the public health order to stay home whenever possible, staying at home than before that public health order.
What kind of movement did we see happen on Election Day?
That's a really good question. So I talked to some researchers from UW-Madison, actually. Well, I talked to the researcher who's heading up this group. They are looking at location tracking data from other third-party vendors than what we looked at. And they want to answer a whole bunch of questions, including they wanted to see what type of effect in-person voting had on movement on Election Day on April 7th. And they found that the effect was really variable across the state. So in places like Madison and Milwaukee, there wasn't so much of a discernible effect. But they did find that the median travel distance that people traveled in counties such as Waukesha or Rock County or Lafayette County was considerably higher on Election Day than on the day prior to it and on other days.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText, and we are talking about the data that they're crunching about where we're moving and how that is changing under the state stay-at-home order. And, Will, I wonder about that, that movement and that travel. You talked about it on Election Day, but does it overall look different for people in different parts of Wisconsin, or can we paint with a broad brush here?
You know, I think we can kind of paint with a broad brush, or we certainly can, in saying that across the state, across all counties, there are more people staying at home now in the weeks after the Safer at Home order than before, for sure. What is different, or what varies quite a bit around the state, is how many more people are staying home than usual. And what we found analyzing data from Cubic, this advertising data company, is that there are a lot more people staying home relative to what would be typical in counties such as Dane County, which has the consistently the highest rate of people staying home, but then also suburban Milwaukee counties, so Waukesha County, Ozaukee County, Fox City's area, Outagamie County, and Green Bay area. And we also saw a seemingly noticeable effect in counties that have four-year UW system campuses, so that'd be Portage County, La Crosse County, Eau Claire, a few others, where there are noticeably more people staying home now in the weeks after the stay-at-home order than before.
Mm-hmm. Do we see these movements starting to pick up now? I mean, people have been home for a month, and you can get kind of squirrely.
For sure. Yeah, I was really interested in whether we would see an effect of quarantine fatigue. I know I myself am feeling a little cooped up at home, and hearing anecdotally from friends and family, a lot of people are wondering, like, is it okay to, like, maybe go visit our grandparents, or to do this thing that at the beginning of these public health orders definitely seemed like a no-no, but now we're 6 weeks into it and we're kind of feeling a little fatigued. Mm-hmm. And what we found was, yeah, it does seem that in the week right after the Safer at Home order, so that last week of March, there was the highest adherence to that, or seemingly there was the highest number of people staying home in that week. And since then, it's been kind of gradually falling in most places across the state. In some counties, as much as 10 or 15% since that peak right after the Safer at Home order.
Let's pivot a little bit. We hear public health officials talking about contact tracing. Are these kinds of technologies and the data that you're finding, could those be used for things like contact tracing in the fight against this new coronavirus?
For sure. I was really interested in that. And this current reporting doesn't focus so much on that, but wanted to look into it a little bit. And the UW researcher that I talked to said that definitely this type of information can be and actually is being leveraged for contact tracing in a number of nations already. That would include places like Singapore and South Korea. I know that location tracking data has been used in Israel, and actually that's been a matter taken to the courts in Israel just in the last couple of days, whether or not the government's use of location tracking data there was legal. And I know that it's been being talked about in Europe as well as in the United States as well. So, the way that location tracking data would be used for contact tracing is quite a bit different than the data that we looked at for this story, which is aggregated, anonymized. It's all kind of like representative samples. You can't see what any individual is doing or where they're moving. Whereas location tracking data that could be used for contact tracing would likely take the form of some sort of app where you opt into it and you are, as a user, actively giving permission to the app to track your location wherever you go. And in case you may be at the grocery store where someone who ended up being confirmed with an infection of COVID-19 was at the same time, authorities could contact you and ask you to self-quarantine.
I can hear brains right now screaming, but silently, like, what about privacy? Like, how can totally. We do this with the data? I mean, what are the different levels of privacy? And you know, how are we trying to grapple with that right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in terms of contact tracing, at least as I understand it in the US, it would definitely have to take the form of an opt-in app where the users are actively giving permission, giving up some of their privacy, maybe to try to help protect their health and the health of their communities. The researcher that I talked to at UW said that for such a contact tracing app to be effective, about at least 60% of the local population would have to opt into it. So that's a pretty high bar to reach, and we'll see what happens, I guess, related to that in the coming months.
Yeah, absolutely. That way, if I were to go someplace, if I had opted in, public health officials could follow up and alert people and try to get a handle on this. That's the concept?
Exactly.
All right. Well, we'll pay attention to what you're working on next. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Keely.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of Wiscontext. He was talking with us about his latest piece looking at cell phone tracking data and what that shows us about how movement has changed across the state since the stay-at-home order was announced last month. You can find out more and check out some of the maps that Wiscontext has put together on their website, wiscontext.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers is asking the state Supreme Court to dismiss a Republican legal challenge to the current Safer at Home order. We get an update on the case from WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Still to come. First, now is the time we're checking up on the week's news in national politics. Lawmakers are starting to consider ideas for a fourth major emergency relief package. States are taking steps to open their economies, even as cases of COVID-19 rise. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell raised the ire of some governors this week when he suggested states going bankrupt should be an option on the table rather than states receiving support from the federal government. You're part of this conversation. Our question for you this week is, what responsibility do you think the federal government has to states in a situation like this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Should a future stimulus bill include money for state and local governments? Are you concerned about the cuts that would have to be made on the state level if the money just isn't there? Or do you think bankruptcy would be a tough but maybe necessary path? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, and he wrote the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, good to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Certainly, as most states continue to keep large parts of their economies closed, it's putting a lot of strain on government finances. Just today, Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers says he plans to cut state spending by 5% in the current fiscal year. What kinds of financial challenges are states around the country looking at?
Yeah, just listening to that news summary that played before we came on the air, it's just stunning to me. The national organizations that deal with state budgets, the state budget organization, the governor's associations, the conference of state legislatures, they're already saying that their local governments and state governments are going to face a deeper gap than we faced during the Great Recession about a decade ago. They're projecting losing up to 20% of their revenue over the coming years. I mean, we're talking multi-years here. California itself is projecting that in a modest recession, and this is going to be worse than that, that they would be facing $50 billion budget holes over a two-year period. That number is going to be revised way up. And just to sort of put a finer point on this, the state governments typically do not have the kind of flexibility that the federal government does. In bad economic times, the federal government can go into more debt. They can basically print more money sell bonds and treasury securities and things like that. States don't have that option. 49 out of the 50 states have a requirement that they have a balanced budget every year. And so that means that when we go into a recession and more people need state services and more people need sort of the social safety net, these states have to start cutting those very services and social safety net. So that's what we're already seeing, big cuts in education, big cuts in things like healthcare systems, and big cuts to even regular government agencies. I mean, the Attorney General of Michigan has already let go a quarter of her entire staff in anticipation of the budget crunch that's coming.
Sure. So then it might be saving state governments a little bit of money, but then you are exacerbating the fact that more people will apply for unemployment or more people will, you know, not have the means to participate and continue to buy things in the economy. I mean, these are all connected.
Yeah, they are. And that's why there are some suggestions that the notion of allowing a state to go into bankruptcy could turn a bad recession into a bad depression and could make all of this a lot worse. That's the case that a lot of the Democrats who support and even Republicans, this isn't necessarily a partisan thing. Even the Republicans who support bailing out the states and getting the federal government more involved are saying that, look, you've got to do this stuff now to prevent a disaster from becoming a catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, you said the B word, bankruptcy. Last week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell weighed in on the potential for more state and local government aid in a future stimulus bill, brought up the prospect of states declaring bankruptcy. Let's listen.
I would certainly be in favor of allowing states to use the bankruptcy route. It saved some cities, and there's no good reason for it not to be available. My guess is their first choice would be for the federal government to borrow money from future generations to send it down to them now so they don't have to do that. That's not something I'm going to be in favor of.
Not all governors responded positively to the majority leader's remark. So what was their response?
Yeah, I don't think any governors responded positively to that. We have heard from Republican and Democratic governors who have basically said that this would be an avenue for absolute disaster in effectively requiring these states to cut their services to the absolute bone at the very time when more people need them. I mean, you mentioned people filing for unemployment benefits. The systems are so bad right now that there are some states that have shifted. I mean, California itself has shifted like 1,300 of its state employees over to a call center just to handle new unemployment benefits. The state of Oregon has a 100,000 person backlog in the number of people who have filed for unemployment benefits in just the last 5 weeks. These are insane numbers that we've never seen before. And so Democratic governors, Republican governors universally condemned Mitch McConnell's statement. It's really hard to imagine how he's going to be able to keep that position when his own senators from states that are in trouble are up for reelection this year. And his own state, which has a Democratic governor, is going to face the same budget cuts as anywhere else. One thing that has been a real line of attack from blue state governors, particularly Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, is that those wealthier blue states, New York, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, places like that, yeah, they tax their residents a lot more, but they also give a lot more money to the federal government than they get back in services. states like Kentucky have a smaller tax base that feeds the federal government less money, but they take back more in services like Medicare and Social Security and things like that. So there are sort of donor states and taker states, and Mitch McConnell represents a state that takes a lot more money from the federal government than it actually gives.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, also an author, and we are talking about the current state of politics. It's our Week in Washington conversation, and we want to know from you, what responsibility does the federal government have to states right now during this COVID-19 pandemic? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let us know what you think about this and whether bankruptcy would be a difficult but important path, or if that's just not how you see the federal government and the states working together. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. McConnell did walk that back a little bit this week, I mean, to a degree, saying that state relief in some form is likely. What are the conditions he's thinking of attaching to that, though, Reed?
Well, we've seen a bunch of proposals that are sort of flying around right now. The process as they're moving towards the fourth version of the coronavirus relief is really up in the air right now. And one thing that I think is driving a lot of McConnell trying to get trying to make this a particular issue is that he's been left out of a lot of the negotiations around the first three rounds of stimulus or relief packages. A lot of them have been negotiated between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. The last round was really a deal between Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader, the Senate Minority Leader, by the way, and Steven Mnuchin. McConnell has been a bit on the sidelines, and he's not accustomed to that in his tenure as the Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate. So this may be a way of forcing him back into the conversation. The Congress has already appropriated about $150 billion to the states. The amounts that they're throwing around now, that what the states might actually need, are truly mind-boggling numbers. The National Governors Association has asked for $500 billion. The National Conference of State Legislatures has asked for $300 billion. The National Association of Counties is asking for billions more for local governments. And then Governor Gavin Newsom of California said the other day in a letter to Nancy Pelosi that the states might need $1 trillion to recover, or at least just to mitigate the fact that the amount of money that they're going to lose based on this. He said that over the next 2 or 3 years, states stand to lose $1.5 trillion, and he's only asking for $1 trillion. I mean, only $1 trillion. What's the old line? $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah, it's really hard to fathom that amount. It's also, I wonder what your take is when we're hearing all of these numbers, when you're reporting all of this information about what states need and the federal government saying, hey, not sure we can help you out. But then we also hear that the federal government is looking at bailouts for major corporations, those, you know, sort of too big to fail entities. How do we square that?
Yeah, that is where we get into a much more partisan discussion over the government's priorities and these small business loans that have instead gone to big corporations like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and Shake Shack and things like that. How do we spend this money? What do we prioritize? And of course, that sort of gets to the fundamental disagreement that Democrats and Republicans have over the size of government and the role of government and who government should be looking out for.
All right. We are talking with Reed Wilson, who's a national correspondent at The Hill and also an author. And we will continue this conversation ahead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the federal government be spending money to support state and local governments as they face big budget shortfalls? Or should states have to make cuts, maybe go bankrupt? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. And our conversation continues here with you on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with Reed Wilson, a national correspondent at The Hill, and we're looking at the response in Washington and around the country to the COVID-19 pandemic. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tom from Port Wing wants to do just that. Hi, Tom.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Here you admitted that the federal government can only print more money and the states can't. So that means that the states should do what every individual does with their budget, which is live within their means. It's really that simple, because printing more money will simply cause every dollar that's out there to be devalued by that amount. And I think the feds are already drunk on money as it is.
All right. Thanks for that, Tom. And, you know, Tom's coming saying, how's the Fed going to print more money? We don't have this money to give to states. Is that something that you've been reporting on, Reid?
Well, I mean, sure. That's the conservative argument on this, or what Mitch McConnell is saying. You heard him in the clip earlier. He said that this is a debt that will be passed on to future generations. I think what you'll hear the Democrats say is that, look, this is a time when more people than ever need the social safety net that these states create, whether it's unemployment benefits or health care or basically anything like that. This is what the sort of emergency button is for, and it's time for the federal government to press it. So, yeah, that's the debate that is raging in Washington. I mean, the arguments here are no different than the arguments we've heard over Republican or Democratic spending priorities for the last, 50, 100 years. The fact is, it's just much more urgent now because there are so many people who are losing their jobs, who need these unemployment benefits, who need the social safety net that are now running dry.
Thanks again for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. We have Dan from DePere who also wants to join the conversation. Welcome, Dan.
Yeah, good afternoon. Some states, when the economy was good, and the economy until recently was very good, saved large rainy day emergency funds, including Wisconsin, by the way. And other states, you know, spend basically every dime that comes in, and they don't save for an emergency like this. And I'm a little suspicious that, you know, the states that were responsible that have savings accounts are going to bail out the states that spent every dollar. So I'd like your guest to comment on that.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Yeah. Reid, what's your take?
Well, Dan, let's talk about the state of California, which I've been reporting on for a long time. The last governor, Jerry Brown, we all thought of him as Governor Moonbeam, the super liberal. Well, as he was building that reputation, he was also saving more money than any state has ever saved in American history. The state's rainy day fund, I talked to their office just the other day, they've got something like $16 billion in reserves. That is unprecedented in American history. Now, if they were allowed, now the statute only allows them to spend half of that money in any given year in a disaster, but if they were allowed to spend all of that money in one year, it still would not cover just the very first year of debt that this crisis has brought on, the funding the gap that this crisis has left. So that gives you a sense of the scale here. Even the state that did the best in saving all their money is effectively going to be out of that rainy day fund before the fiscal year is even over. So that just gives you a sense of the scale of this absolute catastrophe that these states now face.
And then it sounds like the numbers may show that the savings may not go along with our conservative or liberal assumptions that liberal states have lots of debt and conservative states have lots of funds saved away. And suddenly, more conservative leaning states would be at risk of losing much more than states that just went crazy with spending.
Yeah, now, and one of the smart things that a lot of states realized after the Depression, and this is not a partisan thing, this happened in blue states and red states, is that they when they were funding new items when the budget was good, when things were looking good, they were funding them on a one-time basis. So you spend, if you've got an extra $1 billion here, you spend that on something that is going to be completed this year rather than a program that's going to extend way off into the future, because that program will then have to be cut when the bad budget times come. So, people's understanding of state budgets has really evolved since the recession. They were initially planned. I mean, there was going to be another recession no matter what. That's just how the economy works. The fact is, this one is just so much deeper than anything that anybody anticipated that there was basically no planning they could do.
Reid Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, and we are talking about what's going on this week in Washington. And we do have an eye on that phase four bill, Reid. Do we have a sense of the big areas of focus that would be included in a fourth, economic bill?
Well, the county and state and local governments has been the forefront of that. Mm-hmm. The Paycheck Protection Program that we've heard about now a couple of times, that has gone through a couple of rounds of funding, was out of funding almost immediately when they opened again. So you can imagine that that'll probably be another element of spending here. But, you know, this is sort of, I'm old enough to remember Bill Clinton declaring the era of big government was over. Well, the era of big government is back, and it's spending quite a bit of money now, probably more money in the last 2 months than Republicans would pretty much ever be comfortable with in normal times. But then again, these are not normal times.
No, they are not. You've also been following the latest numbers and public health response. I mean, this week, the U.S. saw its 1 millionth confirmed case of COVID-19. How are you seeing these newer cases distributed around the country?
Well, they're moving now. There have been sort of phases to this outbreak. And the first phases started in cities like New York and Seattle, my hometown of Seattle, where the disease was imported from overseas. The Seattle version probably came from Wuhan. The New York version was probably seeded by travelers coming back from Italy, which got hit hard, of course, too. So those were the initial hotspots. Lately, though, we've seen more and more smaller and rural counties getting hit by this virus. And that's troubling for a couple of reasons. First of all, these are counties that have less money and less health capacity than larger counties. You can imagine that, you know, a rural county of 10,000 residents simply doesn't have the health capacity that, say, New York City or Boston does. On the other hand, their populations are older. They are more likely to have pre-existing conditions like hypertension or diabetes or heart disease. So basically, they're more at risk in a place where there's less capacity to care for them. Now, the good news is, in a lot of these rural counties, is that social distancing is something that they practice sort of by nature. There is no subway to ride on. There are, you know, people live a block apart from each other or something like that. There's not sort of the same density issues that makes an outbreak in New York or Milwaukee or places like that more dangerous. We've also seen a significant number of cases in southern cities, in other cities aside from New York and Seattle. New Orleans is now recovering from what was a truly disastrous outbreak. Detroit has really struggled with a number of cases there. Boston is quietly becoming one of the epicenters of this outbreak, one of the hardest hit cities. So we've seen the virus disperse. That's pretty normal. That's the way viruses happen. You tend to get, in the course of, say, a normal flu season, you tend to get the first cases in a big city with an international hub airport, and then the virus then sort of diffuses, to other smaller places across the country. That's what we're seeing now, which means that these rural areas have had time to prepare, and a lot of them have done a really good job in preparing, getting the equipment necessary. But the thing that has really struck me about this particular virus and why it's so different is the number of ways in which it is manifesting in patients. This is not just a virus that carries with it fever, cough, and shortness of breath. This is a virus that now it includes chills, and the symptoms that the CDC are warning about are a loss of a sense of taste and smell. We've heard about a number of people who manifest with pink eye and toe lesions and things like that. So basically, this is a virus that we just don't understand yet. We don't understand how it is attacking so many systems within our bodies and how, you know, it can put some people on a ventilator right away, and other people get it and have absolutely no symptoms, or at least, you know, the mildest of colds. So there's not a ton of rhyme or reason, which makes treating this, finding an appropriate treatment, all the more difficult.
And also probably then makes trying to craft public policy to handle it more difficult, too.
Well, it's funny. The playbook that we're using to fight this virus is the same playbook we've been using for about 100 years. I mean, we started the concept of social distancing back in 1918 during the Spanish flu. We even started things like wearing masks in public back then, 100 years ago, after a plague outbreak in Manchuria, bizarrely enough. But this is so the there's an interesting difference here between first world countries and developing world countries. In first world countries, we put a lot of our emphasis on technology and medicine. That's the way that we know how to treat diseases. We basically throw money at the problem and come up with a drug that can treat it or a vaccine, and that's what we do.
Yep. And it's different around the world with those other barrier methods. Hey, Reed, I'm sorry we have to wrap it up here, but thank you so much for talking with us today.
You got it.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill and the author of the book Epidemic Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. This is Central Time. You may have noticed WPR is doing interviews with guests over the internet or on the phone, not in studio. It helps us all stay safe during COVID-19, and we're not alone. Television outlets, too, are capitalizing on technology, and guests are connecting via video from their living rooms or their home offices with the nice bookcases in the back. And that brings up the issue of pants. Stay with me here. A news reporter from a network that we won't name went on the air in a collared button-up dress shirt and a suit jacket, but he wasn't wearing pants. And we know that because he'd framed the shot to show his professional garb and didn't notice that his leg was visible on screen. This issue is beyond broadcasting, though. In defense of the pantsless, we're meeting over conferencing software that doesn't always show the full image that other people can see on their screens. Still, probably best to put pants on regardless. And there's also talk of pants on social media. I saw a Facebook post from someone who mused she'd put on jeans for the first time in 6 weeks, and they still fit. And a Twitter user thanked a big fashion company for their ads, but said, these are not yoga pants, so pass. Thanks for being with us on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.